Actually, if you could take two different passages, Matthew 1 and Philippians chapter 2. So Matthew 1 and Philippians 2. Matthew 1, verse 21 down through 23, we'll read that. And she shall bring forth a son, and thou shalt call his name Jesus, for he shall save his people from their sins. All this was done that it might be fulfilled which was spoken of the Lord by the prophet, saying, Behold, a virgin shall be with child, and shall bring forth a son. They shall call his name Emmanuel, which being interpreted is God with us. And then Philippians 2. Philippians 2. And verses 7 through 9. If somebody could read those, that would be great. Now, it's interesting because in Matthew, we see that Jesus' name is Emmanuel, which literally means God with us. And in Philippians, we have an account that Paul gives to us. And in verse 7, the King James records it this way, but made of himself of no reputation. It took upon him the form of a servant, was made in the likeness of men. It's interesting because a lot of different translations will take that word, that's reputation, and it'll be translated emptied himself or something along that line. So it would read something like, but emptied himself and took upon himself the form of a servant. And the word in the Greek is the word kenu. And it literally means to empty, to make void, to abase, or to make of none effect. Those are the different meanings that that word has. The definition comes out of Thayer's Greek definitions, which is one of the better Greek definition books. And I thought it would be kind of interesting because there are many people that are out there. And there's many study Bibles that present that Jesus Christ emptied himself of the attributes of deity. And when he came to the earth, he wasn't quite God, but he was more than man, is the idea that a lot of religions teach. If you've ever had a Jehovah's Witness knock on your door, for instance, they would teach that idea, that Jesus is he emptied himself of any attribute of deity. He's not quite God. He's not equal to God. He's not the same as the Father. He's lesser than the Father, but he's more than a man. And they would say that he through his sinless life, actually attained deity. So deity is something that you can earn in their theology. And they take a lot of that idea from this passage, that he emptied himself, that he somehow became less than what he was. It's interesting as you continue down. If you go to the preceding verse, verse 6, being in the form of God, thought it not robbery to be equal with God. Now, this verse is significant because almost every translation in the world gets the plural wrong here. The word equal is always translated in the singular, and it's actually plural in the Greek. In fact, in every Greek manuscript, it's plural. So it would read this way, who being in the form of God thought it not robbery to be equals with God. Now, that changes it a lot. To be equals would imply what?
That idea that
that he already was, that he is God. It also would imply that there's more than one. Okay? But the main idea there is that he would be equal to God. That they're synonymous. God and Jesus are synonymous in that sense. An important issue when you look at the word God. Okay? Most people will look at it and they'll go to Deuteronomy, for instance, and they'll say God is one. And he is. But the word one there doesn't mean the number one. It means unified one. The same with, for instance, one Lord, one faith, right? The word one throughout that passage is unified. It doesn't mean singular. So when you're looking at it, if it's plural, to be equals with God, it opens up the possibility that there's more than one being who constitutes God.
And family is that, or
just? Well, family would denote something lesser. Because again, God, we're his offspring, we're his family, right? So the reason the word equals is important there is it opens the door for more than one being. Now that's not to say that from this passage you could get that, because again, it could be understood the way that you said you're equals with your wife. And that could connotate your one, as in unifying together. It could mean that idea, or it could mean that there's one being who's equals with more than one other being.
They have the same function. But technically, you're not equal to each other. But with God, you're exactly the same.
Right. Right.
You're not exactly the same. You're different.
It is a hard concept. And I don't want to do something on, you know, the different views of God in that sense. I want to keep it specifically where we're dealing with the deity of Jesus Christ, who is the Emmanuel, who is God with us. When we celebrate this time of year, we have to realize that he wasn't born in December 1st. He just wasn't. You would possibly conceive at this time of year, but most likely he would have been born sometime in September, late September.
So that the marriage
Yeah. Well, most historians will place it somewhere between the year 3 BC and 8 BC. Well, again, we know that it was sometime in September. We know that.
Sure.
We know that for sure.
He was already pregnant.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we know that she gave birth when she was in Bethlehem. So, as she's there for the census, she gave birth.
She was very well.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but it's God with us. And a lot of people try from verse 7 of Philippians 2 to make Jesus lesser than God. If he emptied himself of the attributes of deity, then can God be God if he doesn't have God's attributes? No, he can't be. He'd be lesser. He wouldn't be God. Dangerous to say what?
He
wouldn't be.
Part of being God is the aspect that only comes forth.
Right.
God is glorious.
Right.
He's happy to come forth.
Right.
There was not any glory for Jesus to offer.
didn't empty himself, is the whole point.
One fifth God, his character of God, his care of God, the power of God, his infinite check of God.
Let me look at this word to know, though. Because it has the meaning to empty. It has the meaning to make void. It also has the meaning to abase or to make of no effect or to hold in check, sort of the idea. The King James translators use the idea of to hold in check or to abase. That sort of idea is correct. He didn't exalt himself. He didn't take himself and exalt himself above any other aspect of who God is. That's correct.
He didn't come on like Charlton Heston.
Right. He didn't come on like Charlton Heston. You're right. He came where he looked like a normal person. You wouldn't know he was God just from looking at him. Right? And I'm going to submit that that actually fills the Old Testament types, that presentation. And that's why I think the King James translators got this verse right. I know a number of weeks, you know, I'll say, well, it should be translated this way or that way. This is one verse they really got right. And it actually is a very good translation of Philippians 2:7. If you go back with me, I want to look at some of the Old Testament ideas, and then we'll kind of go from there and work our way forward. But if you go back into the book of Leviticus chapter 6, if somebody could read verse 11. Actually, before you go to Leviticus 26:11, let's go to Exodus 28:2.
Exodus
28. Exodus 28 and verse 2. Keep your hand in Leviticus. Okay. 28:2. Okay. Yeah. 28:2. Okay, so here we have a passage where Moses is being instructed on how the priests are going to be clothed and some of the rituals to put a person into the priest's office. And they're making garments. And the garments are for glory and for beauty. Now, I wanna look here for a second. God is a spirit being, is he not? He's clothed with light, for instance, we know from Psalms. You know, that his garments are light. God is light. God is a spirit and God is love. Those are the three things that God is referred to as being. But having said that, in order to take on a body, he has to put a garment over the light. And he has to put on flesh like we would have in order to be a man, right? Now, it's interesting because we could get into an awesome study on the body of Adam and the fact that Adam's body was designed where it could house God. Think about that for a second. Our bodies were designed so that even in a corrupted, fallen state, when I say that, I mean when sin was introduced, I don't mean our nature is necessarily corrupted and fallen in that regard. But sin has been introduced into the equation. That might be a better way to state it. Once sin was introduced into the equation, we didn't operate the same way we used to operate. Our bodies didn't work the way they were designed to work. So, even in that body, Adam, in his body, was designed where it could still house God. about that. That's pretty cool. Right? It tells you how glorious these bodies are amongst all the beings that exist. But having said that, to go into the priest's office, Aaron was to put on some garments. And his garments were for glory and for beauty. Now, if you go to Leviticus 6, in verse 11, told everybody to take that passage and I didn't. We could get somebody who hasn't read, maybe read that verse. Now it's cool. What you have here is that the priest is putting off his garments and putting on a different garment. Why is he doing that? Well, so that he could carry ashes of a burnt sacrifice outside the camp. The burnt sacrifice was done for an atonement. A better way to look at that would be a propitiatory shelter is the idea. That he would do that. And then it was also done for a trespass offering. Verse 7, for instance, lays that out. So you would have these garments that would be put off by the priest as he went outside the camp to make atonement for the people. Now, it's interesting, when Jesus Christ came down to planet Earth, he was in his original condition before he came to Earth in bodily form. He was clothed with light. So, follow the analogy, he takes off that garment, the garment of glory and beauty, and puts on the lesser garment so that he can do something outside the camp. Right, the overall. Linen breeches is the way the King James will translate it. So the idea is that, the idea here is that he took off what was glorious and beautiful to put on something that wasn't. Okay? And it was so that he could do a work outside the camp. Now, with that, if you go to Ezekiel 44:19, Ezekiel 44 and verse 19, somebody could read that.
And then they go forth to the other force, even unto the other force to the people, and shall put off the garments wherein they ministered, and lay them in the holy chambers, and shall put on other garments, and they shall not sanctify the people with their garments.
In other words, in order to sanctify the people, they would have to put off the nice garments. Those nice garments would stay in the sanctuary. Then he would put on the lesser garments in order to sanctify or to set apart or to make holy the people. So it would be this idea. The priest is in the temple. In order to make the sacrifice, in order to cleanse the people, to set them apart as holy, they would take off their garments of glory and beauty, leave them in the sanctuary, come out of the sanctuary in lesser garments, and then in those lesser garments make atonement for the people. It's almost like the idea of the Lord Jesus Christ. Paul says that though he were rich, yet he became poor, that he through his poverty might be rich. Right? The idea is that he left all the glory and splendor of heaven, of the Epiranos sphere, to come down to this terrestrial globe. He didn't allow his glory and beauty to shine forth, but rather he kept himself in these garments of humanity. Is sort of an idea that's going on here. The priesthood represented them. They had the garments of glory and beauty when they were acting as the intercessor on behalf of the people. But then when they were doing the sacrifices, they had to take off those garments and take on a drab-looking garment that wasn't beautiful and it wasn't glorious. In fact, it was rather drab and most likely pretty bloody-looking. Okay? It wasn't appealing. And the Lord, right, like a butcher's apron. I mean, it's not an appealing-looking apron, right? But it's designed to do a work. It's designed to do a task. And the Lord Jesus Christ, in order to be that sacrifice for us, had to have a body that was designed for that task. If you go to Hebrews 10, and in Hebrews 10, in verse 1, I want to go through verse 1 down through verse 5. I'll read verse 1, we can maybe read it around, so we'll get through verse 5. For the law, having a shadow of good things to come, and not the very image of the things, can never with those sacrifices which they offered year by year, continually make the comers thereunto perfect.
For whence would they not have ceased to be offered, but that the worshippers once first should have had no more practice to sin.
In other words, the Lord had a body that was prepared for him. Now, what was it prepared for? It was prepared for him to be the perfect sacrifice. Was the body glorious? No. Was the body beautiful? No. He had to put off, in that sense, or veil, or abase himself, so that their glory and beauty didn't emanate from him. There was one brief time where he allowed it. Rick had alluded to it at the Mount of Transfiguration. And even there, it wasn't the full glory and the full beauty of the Lord's name. It was just enough where they got a glimpse, and Peter's still writing about it 20-plus years later.
He would have died?
Yeah, I believe so, too. They couldn't end up that full glory. So you look at that, and there's some things that are going on here, which is really, really cool. And this was all done outside the camp. If you go to chapter 13, and in chapter 13, It's kind of interesting when you look at some of the things here. Let's go to verse 10 through 12. 13. 10 through 13. We have an altar whereof they have no right to eat, which serve the tabernacle. For the bodies of those beasts whose blood is brought into the sanctuary by the high priest for sin, are burned without the camp, or outside the camp. Wherefore Jesus also, that he might sanctify the people with his own blood, suffered without the gate. Let us go forth therefore unto him without the camp, bearing his reproach. The idea is that he suffered outside the camp. It's interesting, if you look at it, they would lead him outside the gates of Jerusalem to a place called Golgotha, which most likely is part of Moriah, Mount Moriah range. And in that range, he was offered, he was sacrificed outside the camp. And it's fitting all of the Old Testament typology. The priest had to put off the garments of glory and beauty. The priest had to burn the ashes outside the camp to dispose of the body outside the camp. They weren't allowed to do certain things. They had to leave their garments of glory and beauty in the sanctuary. When Jesus Christ left the Apollonius sphere, he left his glory, well, he didn't allow his glory and beauty to be seen on this planet except at the Mount of Transfiguration. So it's kind of neat when you begin to see all of those things. Going even further with that, even further with it. In the book of Luke 24, somebody wants to go there. Luke 24, if somebody could read verses 25 through 27.
In order to do the sacrifices and to make atonement for the people.
Now, the Lord was able to go one better. He didn't just make an atonement or a propitiatory shelter or covering. What he did is he actually came and was a total satisfying sacrifice, never to be done again. The other ones all had to be replicated every year. That's what Hebrews was getting at. So when we compare it, the type works until Christ comes, and then Christ goes beyond the type because they had to do it all the time. He only had to do it once. Once for all time, which is really awesome, right? So that glory was veiled. We also will see that Jesus's beauty was veiled. If you go to Isaiah 53, verse 2. Bless you. For he shall grow up before him as a tender plant, and as a root out of a dry ground. He hath no form nor comeliness, and when we shall see him, there is no beauty that we should desire him. In other words, he's not very good looking. Why is he not very good looking? Bless you. If you go back to chapter 52, this is why he wasn't very good looking. Verse 14, somebody could read that. In other words, his visage was marred, and he was beaten basically to a bloody pulp. And he literally was repulsive at that point in time. He had no form of comeliness. When we shall see him, there is no beauty that we should desire him. In other words, he goes on in verse 3 of Isaiah 53. He is despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. He was despised, he goes on to say. In the whole thing, he carried their sorrows, and he was stricken and smitten of God and afflicted. That's not glorious, and that's not beauty. That's something altogether different. Yes, is he talking about the prophet Isaiah here? Possibly. But he's also talking, and he has a reference that goes beyond Isaiah, to the Lord himself. And he's definitely talking about that as well. He was cut off from the land, if you go to verse 8. He was taken from prison and from judgment. Who shall declare his generation? For he was cut off out of the land of the living. For the transgression of my people was he stricken. He made his grave with the wicked. It's interesting. Remember how it said that thou shalt not leave his soul in hell? Right, in the King James, it would be the Hebrew word Sheol. The Greek equivalent would be Hades. And it literally is the grave, or the pit, or the unseen is actually a better way to understand that. He's not visible anymore. But even with that, he makes a reference here where he talks about taking him from the prison to judgment. And remember when you have that one parable where the Lord's talking and he talks and he says, well, they'll go to the council, and then from the council to the judgment to the prison, right? And then to be cast out into Gehenna. It's all being played out here in Isaiah 53, that whole idea. His body is burned with the wicked. Well, where's the wicked? That's the whole idea that's going on. He's being buried with the wicked. He's being numbered with them. He's been judged against by the council. The council had decided against him. The judgment went against him. He was taken to prison. He was sentenced to death. It's the whole idea that's going on. And he suffered outside the camp. He had literally veiled his glory and beauty so that all that could be seen was suffering and a visage that's so marred that he's not recognizable even as a person. But Isaiah is a fascinating book, and it has something cool to say. And it says here in chapter 4, Isaiah 4, verse 1. And in that day, seven women shall take hold of one man, saying, we will eat our own bread and wear our own apparel. Only let us be called by thy name to take away our reproach. In that day shall the branch of the Lord be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the earth shall be excellent and comely for them that are escaped of Israel. Now, we could really have an interesting study on the time segment that he's talking about here. That's a different study altogether. Here's the whole point. There is a day coming when they will wear their own apparel again. And when that happens, the branch of the Lord will come in beauty and glory, and then he will be comely and excellent for all of Israel. Isn't that what the resurrection accomplished for the Lord Jesus Christ? When he ascended back up into heaven, he ascended back into the Epiphanius sphere, and now he's glorified. In fact, in Philippians 2, let's go back there. Paul goes through the whole thing, which is really cool. Philippians 2. Verse 8 and 9. And being found in fashion as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. Wherefore, God also hath highly exalted him and given him a name which is above every name. What name was it in Isaiah they wanted to be called by? His name. Why? Because his name is the exalted name. That's where the glory and the beauty is. His name becomes the issue. And then it goes on and it says, and that every tongue should confess that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father. Now, all of it's going to bring glory to the Father, but it also brings glory to the Son. When the Lord Jesus Christ, for instance, looks up into heaven on the road to Damascus, he's blinded, right? Because he saw a brief glimpse of a light that outshone the noonday sun. And that's the Lord Jesus Christ who he saw. In fact, isn't he light? He's clothed with his light again. He's glorious. Remember in Job, when it's talking about Adam, Job goes on and he talks about how his light was put out. It's the phraseology that Job uses. And the idea is that we know that when Adam sinned, something changed. And what I would submit is he had a body that was beautiful and glorious. And that body now became veiled with something that wasn't. The light was extinguished, and the day is going to come when every single individual, one by one, will have that light put back into existence, and they will emanate that glory and beauty that God intended. It's a magnificent thing. Why? Because they'll be known by whose name? his name. They're heirs of God, joint heirs with Christ. They're the sons and daughters of God. They are his beings that are going to manifest certain things about him. In fact, Adam is the only being that's ever said to be in the likeness of God. It's interesting. Adam is in the likeness of God. He sins, and then Seth is in his likeness. Right? Meaning Adam's likeness. In Philippians 2, Jesus has to take upon himself the likeness of men so that he can reverse the likeness of men to something glorious and beautiful. It's almost like Jesus has to take on the form of all of the sons of Adam so that he can restore back what Adam lost. It's a beautiful picture. That's what Christmas is about, by the way. When we celebrate Jesus coming down to this planet, what we're celebrating is that he left the glory and the beauty that he had to come here, to live a perfect life, to make of himself of no reputation, so that he could become our sacrifice and offering, and by doing so, win life for every creature that has ever existed.
The restoration of all things.
The restoration of all.
It includes more
than man. It does. It's the restoration of everything. It brings everything back into alignment with God, so that God can really and truly be all in all. The whole creation groans and fails. That's right. Right.
And
it gives new meaning to that. And go with me to Romans 8. I want to close with this passage. Since you brought it up, it's a good passage to close with. We ourselves are going to go through that same transformation. He had to veil his glory and beauty because he always was and always will be glorious and beautiful. We, on the other hand, that's not true of us. We will have to put on glory, and we'll have to put on beauty. Now follow how it happens. He says here in verse 17 of Romans 8, verse 16, the Spirit itself beareth witness with our spirit that we are the children of God. And if children, then heirs, heirs of God, and joint heirs with Christ. If so be that we suffer with him, that we may be also glorified together. For I reckon that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. Remember, he, in his humanity, he had to suffer before he could take back the glory, right? Well, the same is true of us. We have to suffer in this life before the glory is going to be revealed in us. He goes on, for the earnest expectation of the creature waiteth for the manifestation of the, what's the next word? World. The sons of God. Who's the sons of God that's to be manifested? Us. Beauty, it's us. For the creature was made subject to vanity. In other words, for the creature was made subject to no reputation. That's an interesting thing. Not willingly. Ours wasn't willing. His was. He willingly veiled his glory and beauty. We, on the other hand, didn't willingly veil ours. We were stripped of it, so to speak. Right? Not willingly, but by reason of him who hath subjected the same in hope, because the creature itself also shall be delivered from the bondage of corruption into the glorious liberty of the children of God. So For we know that the whole creation groaneth and travaileth in pain together until now. The whole idea he's getting at is that the whole creation has been subjected to this suffering for the purpose that it would eventually produce glory. Now, God didn't make his creatures to be, he didn't design his creatures where he knew that they were going to sin, and therefore he could subject them to suffering. He created them with the decision, with the ability to make a decision. I'll either obey or I'll disobey. Which decision they made was totally dependent upon them. When they made the wrong decision, God gave them, brought in this idea of subjecting them to this suffering. Why? So that they could understand what sin produced. It's not that he designed man for the purpose of causing man to sin so that man could suffer, so that God could somehow be glorified in that. God would have been just as glorified if Adam had never sinned. And he would have been happier if man not sinned. There would have been no grief on his end, no suffering on his end. But man did sin, so he had to let man learn the lesson. It's like if you're dealing with a little child, right? When they're first born, you look at all the potential they have, and you hope they make the right decisions, but inevitably they're going to make some bad decision that you got to come down hard on them for, right? Well, the same was true with Adam when he sinned. God had to come down hard on him for that sin. It's not that he made him a sinner so that he could be glorified in Adam's sin. He would have been glorified if Adam had never sinned. But in this whole thing, it works so that they themselves could understand the futility of what life is without God. And he subjected them to that. And the creation now is waiting for that day when it's liberated and receives that new, glorious, and beautiful body fashioned like unto his glorious and beautiful body. Notice here verse 23. And not only they, but ourselves also, which have the first fruits of the Spirit, even we ourselves grown within ourselves, waiting for the adoption, to wit, the redemption of our body. When is it that we receive that glorious and beautiful body? Resurrection. At the day of resurrection, yep. That's why we're waiting for the redemption of the body. In Philippians, he talks about our citizenship being in the heavens, right? And it says that we're going to receive a body. We're going to be morphed into a body like unto his. It says in the King James, verse 21 of Philippians 3, who shall change our vile body, that it may be fashioned like unto his glorious body, according to the working whereby he is able even to subdue all things unto himself. Now, he's not subduing some things. It's all things. And how does he do that? By changing the vile bodies and fashioning them to be like his glorious body. That's what awaits us. So that's what was accomplished. He always was Emmanuel. He always was God with us. And there were times in his life he allowed his deity to show forth, and there were times he didn't. And it all depended on what it was that he was doing at that particular point in time and what lesson he was trying to teach. For instance, he could heal people by just having a person touch him. He could heal a person by not even going to the person. Remember the centurion? Lord, you don't have to come. You can heal him where you are. And he commends the centurion for having such faith. And he goes, go and your child will be healed, right? He didn't even have to be there. He could raise people from the dead. He could raise himself from the dead. the availability. So, I mean, he always was God. Never, ever was he anything less than God. He also became fully man. And when he became fully man, he veiled himself for a time. But it was always there. Right? And the beauty is, through that typology that's all there in the Old Testament with the garments of the priesthood and the way they did the sacrifices and all those things, it tells us some things about how it is that we're going to be transformed and made like unto him. It's a wonderful thing. Did it confuse anyone? Is it clear?
The world never learns the lesson of
yourself, your belief. Yeah, it hasn't learned it yet. It will. At some point it will. It just hasn't yet. Okay. Well, he died because he gave up his life himself. He didn't die as a result of sin. He died as a result that he sacrificed himself. He's the only one that died without being a sinner. Well, he was scared. And in his humanity, he didn't want it to be that way. But then again, in the end, nevertheless, he died, will be done. So he submitted his will so that he could bring about that redemption for all of us. You know, so he knew he was going to die when he came to this planet.
He was here and he prayed,
I don't think he was scared about that. I think what he was afraid of
is that he lifted up an old dog.
Right. I think what he was afraid of more than anything is the process. You have to remember, he's fully God, but he's also fully man. The deity was pleased to do it. That's what Isaiah 53 says. He was pleased to do it. The humanity was just like us. He was afraid. He had a conflict that was raging in that sense. The word is sorrowful unto death is the way it's phrased. That's a fancy way of saying he was extremely depressed. It's the idea of when you know you've worked your whole life for people you love, they've all rejected you, you're going to be discouraged and depressed. You're going to lament. The flip side is, when you know that you're doing something that's going to benefit everyone that you care for, you feel happy and joyful about them. So the deity feels happy and joyful. The humanity is discouraged. It's interesting because at Calvary, when he says it is finished, well, what does he mean? Well, what he means there is that the sin sacrifice is over. He's sacrificed himself. The only thing left now is for him to die. Yeah. It is finished. So what he has to do now is to give up his life. And that's where he gives up his spirit. He says, Father, into thine hands I commend my spirit. Well, God is a spirit. His spirit is deity. The deity goes back to heaven. The physical body goes into the grave. The soul, when you have a spirit joined into a body, goes into Sheol or Hades, the unseen place, awaiting resurrection. When he comes back, right, takes back his own life from the grave, it's the uniting of the spirit, deity, with the body, man, he becomes a living soul again, and he's alive again, never to die. So, you know, to answer that, his death never was because of sin, unlike ours. That's where it breaks down a little bit. It is, right, he's the only one that ever sinned. And he had to, in fact, he could have hung on the cross forever. Because he wasn't capable of that. The wages of sin is death. So the only way he could die is to give up his own life.
They still talk on the radio that, you know, he became sin for us. He paid the penalty, that he became sin.
He didn't become sin.
They still say that. They still say that.
Yeah, that's a bad understanding. He became the sin offering. Right. See, if he became sin, then he's a sinner. Then he's not perfect. Right? And the other thing that people have wrong is they'll say he was our substitute. He wasn't our substitute. Never was. Couldn't be. Because we all still die. And because if he was our substitute, he would have paid our penalty, which means that none of us would be capable of death upon belief. The wages of sin is death. He didn't take that away. People die. Why? Because they sin. So, but he is our sacrifice. He was our offering. He became our sin offering. And, you know, I think in in Corinthians, if he would have used the phrase sin offering there instead of he became sin. Unfortunately, in the original languages, offering is implied. You don't have to say it. Sometimes the English translations will catch the idiom. Sometimes they don't. And it happens to be a verse most translations don't catch the idiom. There are some translations that do. I do believe it's either Rotherham or Young's literal translation actually has sin offering there.
Right, they didn't
become sin. No. In fact, it's interesting too that the scapegoat doesn't die. It's released. Yeah, people try to say he became our scapegoat, right? Well, if that was the case, then he wouldn't have died. They just don't understand it.
Somebody once on the radio said that this boat was sent off to a desert area where it died of thirst.
Well, was sent out into the wilderness, and we don't know what becomes of it. It doesn't tell us. It could have lived a long time, or maybe it did it. Yeah. Found a nice family and made other little goats. I don't know. But yeah, the... Azazel. It's interesting too, because the satanic verses in the Quran, right, make a reference to Azazel, which was a demonic spirit in the Quran, and the demonic spirit actually gave, and it's recorded by Muhammad, actually gave him inspiration to record verses in the Quran. Tells you how they right. And it's very possible it might have been.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. That was a number of years ago when I did that.
Okay.
It's very possible it may have been.
Mm-hmm. Very well at it. But our he did say a couple of days ago.
God is going to reward you for that.
an answer was this, where when you're raised and you're at the bema of Christ, he's going to dispense rewards, and it's going to be based off of a lot of those things, you know, the works that we did, how we allowed his life to work its way through us, how we may not have allowed his life to work through us. And the end result is we are going to be glorified in some way, shape, or form through it. So, kind of a neat thing. I wish I could say, you know, this is exactly how it works, but...
Well, it's simple, but it's complex. The simplicity of it is that you look through everything through the eyes of Christ, and it's just here. It's complex, but it ain't easy to do.
It's not easy to do. And in a lot of ways, grace can be harder than law, because sometimes people want to be told what to do. Under grace, you become responsible for what you do. Under the law, I'm responsible for somebody else's rules. So in that sense, grace can be maybe sometimes more difficult, yet it's liberty, where law is bondage. Liberty is freedom, and people will die for freedom. Nobody dies to be in bondage. You know, so it's a way to think about it. No, you don't see that. You don't see, you don't see political refugees in a hurry to go back to the country that they fled from. You know, they go to a country to get away. So, does Ohio have anything that...
Well, very good study. When you said that, when he said on the cross that it is finished, that the work for the sin was already done, it reminded me of a type when Samson took the jawbone of a donkey and he slew I don't know how many Philistines, and after the battle was over, he said, "I thirst." And I can't help think that when the battle was won, when Christ was on the cross, he also said he thirsts. I think that's a typology there, too, that is real good. And then he says that it's finished, you know, and I don't know what you think about that, but I think that's other, that while he was on the cross, there was so much suffering. It was a real battle that I don't think we can relate to, but he was in that. And when he won, he says, "I thirst." That's what I think.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think you're dead on this. Yeah, I think you're totally right on that. I'd agree with that.
Well, very good study, Bill. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
When's the next one?
I know it's Christmas week. Really, the only day that really works good for me is Sunday evening. I don't know if that works for everybody else.
Sunday
evening? The 21st, yeah. Right.
You say the 21st?
Well, we're talking it through. Does that work for everybody?
I'll be out of town, so you can call Ted.
Okay. I have Ted's number. I can call him direct.
Okay.
Okay.
We'll figure the 21st then. Sunday evening.
Okay.
Okay, we'll be at Cindy's. Okay. So the 21st it is.
Okay. Sounds good, guys.
Good night. Take care. Good night.
All right. Good night. Good night.